7 3 through 8. You are dismissed for Children's Church. Anyone else blow it this week? You didn't know you were going to have to confess this morning. So I was driving our kids to school this week, and one of the things that we like to do on our way to school is just kind of take advantage of that time and leverage it in prayer for the day. And so we have this sort of routine that we do, and whoever's sitting behind Dad has to start, and then we go around counterclockwise, and it ends with me. And we just pray for our day, and when it gets to me, I like to say different things and mix it up, but I always try to end with like a just a blessing over our family, and invite Jesus kind of formally into our day at that minute. And before you get too impressed, you want to finish my story here. So we're driving along, and we're going, and we're praying, and sure enough, it comes to me, and I pray, and it's a good one. I invite Jesus into our day and just pray his blessing over our family, and that God would bring us back together that evening, and that we would glorify him in all we do and say that day, and say amen. And in that moment, I find myself at a familiar place. It's 30th and Lorraine. And if you know where we live and you know where our kids go to school, we're headed southbound down Lorraine, and we come to the stoplight at 30th Street, and we're going to make a left turn and head east down 30th to Union Valley Bible, or to Union Valley Elementary School. And, you know, there's a lot of things that I really love about this community. There's one thing I really hate about this community, and it happens at 30th and Lorraine almost every single day. And it goes like this. So I pull into my left-hand turning lane, and I'm desiring, once I get my green arrow, to turn left and to go to the school. Now, some of you might want to listen up at this point, okay, because I'm going to show you how this is done, okay? So in Nebraska, when we're making a left-hand turn into two lanes of traffic, you always pull into which lane? The left lane, the closest one. Okay, good. You guys know that. Good. I knew it wasn't you guys that I was running into out there. However, almost daily at 30th and Lorraine, my faith is tested as I try to make a left-hand turn. And then once I get into my left-hand lane, I know that I'm eventually going to want to be in the right-hand lane to turn to go to Union Valley Elementary. At which point, what do? I put my turn signal on, I look and make sure it's clear, and I move over. And without fail, whoever is behind me every single day is in a bigger hurry than I am, I guess. And they hate it. I pull into the left lane, but they also love it because they're going to use it as their opportunity to get around me in the right lane. And almost daily, I look back only to see a car nearly colliding with me as I'm trying to move over, because I did it right. Let's just be honest, okay? So this is happening again, moments after I just invited Jesus into our day, prayed a blessing over our family. And, you know, one of our neighbor kids rides with us every morning. He's a kindergartner. He's a sweet kid. And I tell our kids all the time, I'm like, look, you know, this is a great opportunity for our family to just be Jesus to this little boy, and for us to just exemplify who Jesus is and what he does and his love and his kindness and all these things. And I tell our kids this all the time. But this day, Dad loses it. I pull out, I go into the lane, I'm getting ready to shift, and sure enough, here comes this, I won't mention the gender of the driver, but next to me, and I go to pull over, and I go, oh, come on! Learn how to drive! I couldn't take it anymore, and at that moment, it was one of those moments where it's like, get back, Dad is losing it, Okay, women and children, plug your ears. It's not going to be good. And in that moment, I just lost it. And I thought, what in the world, Jason? Is this really that big of a deal? Yes, it is, by the way. But nevertheless, in that moment I was left here, I just felt so guilty and just so foolish. Here I just slept on my Dad of the Year award as I'm praying blessings over my children, inviting Jesus into my day. And not 2 seconds later, I'm acting like an idiot behind the wheel in front of my kids and everyone else on 30th Street. And it's at that moment I'm like, God, wouldn't it be nice just if God would just send someone down in that moment and be like, hey, I know what you're about to do. I know it. You're at 30th in the rain. Let me just pull you back. Let me just remind you who you are in Christ. Let me just remind you what God's doing in your life. Wouldn't that be great? Well, I'm going to argue this morning. I think he does do that. We just don't always listen for it or looking for it. But especially in today's story, we're gonna go back to our story with David. And he's going to have one of these moments where he loses it. And we're going to see how God provides for him in that moment to pull him back, to call him out who he is, to remind him of where he's going. So turn in your Bibles with me, if you're not already there, to 1 Samuel chapter 25. 1 Samuel chapter 25, I left my notes in the pew. I forgot what page it's on. I think it's 20-something, 206 maybe, if you're using a pew Bible. Some of you are looking at me like, honey, it's not that. It's not that on that page. It's not you. It's if you're using the pew Bible. It's 20-something. 1 Samuel chapter 25. And while you're turning, I just want to remind us of where we've been. We've kind of been doing this side series in the book of 1 Samuel when Pastor Steve's gone. And so far we've learned that 1 Samuel opens up. And at the beginning of the book, God's in control. He's ruling over his people in this beautiful theocracy. But the problem is the people of Israel, God's chosen people, are in the process of rejecting God as their king. They want a real king. They want a man king like everyone else around them has. And so they go through this sort of battle with God, and they demand this king. And God says, you know what? It's not good for you. It's not the right time. But essentially said, you know what? This is what you want. I'll give it to you. And so they get a king, and his name is King Saul. Perfect. And is King Saul, what's he like? Is he a good guy? No. He starts out okay. But what do we know about King Saul? He's tall, he's dark, he's handsome. He looks pretty kingly, right? Good. He fits the bill as far as what we want out of an earthly king. He's a head higher than everyone else. He's got the stature. He seems kingly, but not long after we meet King Saul, we see him begin to just put it in the ditch over and over and over again. And we find out that Saul essentially grows into this kind of self-absorbed, disobedient leader. Finally, God has enough, and he says, you know what? I cannot rule my people effectively through a man like this. And so he begins to raise up another leader whose name was David. Very good. David was found. We met him first in 1 Samuel chapter 16. And where did we find David? Down the pasture, right? With the sheep. God says, look, I've got another guy in mind for the job. This guy's a man after my own heart. And I'm going to raise this young guy up. And he's going to be the next king of Israel. And he's going to lead my people in a way that Saul has not been able to. And so God speaks to Samuel. He's sort of his prophet at this time. He sends Samuel to the house of Jesse. Jesse has a bunch of boys, and they go through the line, oldest to smallest, and sure enough, there's nobody there that God is confirming as the king. And finally, they get down to the last one, and Samuel's like, Jesse, do you got any more kids running around here? And as a father with a lot of kids would say, oh yeah, there is one more running around here. And Jesse's out in the pasture. And they bring, or no, sorry, not Jesse. David's out in the pasture, and Jesse calls to bring David in. And as David gets brought in, Samuel is confirmed in the Lord that this is the next king. And so here this young little shepherd boy, just barely a teenager, is being anointed as king in his dad's own home. And so then for the rest of 1 Samuel, we've been watching to see, God, how are you going to take a young shepherd boy like David and turn him into a king? And so that's kind of what we've been studying. And, you know, if you didn't know the story, you might think that God was inviting David into this royal sort of preparation time where he's maybe invited into the palace and he's schooled by the famous school teachers of the day and goes through this just wonderful pampering of preparation. But is that David's experience? No. You read the story, and God's method of turning David from a shepherd boy into a king is actually really messy. It actually doesn't make a lot of sense at times from David's perspective, probably. And it's actually been a season of hardship for David. In fact, he's already lost his wife. He's lost his best friend. He's lost his family. He's been separated from them all. And now we find him, he's on the run. As you read David's story, begin to ask yourself, God, is this really how you treat your kings? Like, seriously? Like, I thought that you called this young man to be the next leader of your people. And yet it looks like he's kind of in a bad way all the time. And as we read through that story, we see God use each one of these messy, hard situations that none of us would choose, nevertheless, to fortify something inside of David to make him into the kind of man that he's going to need to become king. So that's kind of where we're at in our story in general. The only thing more specific I could say is that David is on the run now. King Saul, the current reigning king, the bad one, remember? He's not doing a good job, and he's very jealous of David because he knows that David is going to succeed him. He knows that he's in the process of being replaced, and so he has committed to getting rid of David before that can happen. And so David is on the run, he's on the hunt, and Saul is determined at whatever cost to get rid of David. And so as we pick up our story today, we find David on the run again, waiting for God to act and to move and to make him king. But I'll be honest with you, today's story is a little bit weird in that we don't read anything about King Saul today. So far, all of our story so far between David has been with him and King Saul, this just sort of drama that's been going back and forth. But today it's almost as if chapter 25 serves as some parentheses in our story. You're not going to hear about Saul today. We're actually going to read about the drama that David runs into with another guy named Nabal. So, with that being said, turn in your Bibles if you're not already there. 1 Samuel 25, we're going to pick up the very first verse, and it says this. Now Samuel died. Who is Samuel again? Samuel is kind of God's prophet at this time that he's been speaking through and that God has been using to represent himself to his people Israel at this time. This is significant. When we picked up our story in 1 Samuel, the first few chapters, we were introduced to a guy named Eli. Do you remember Eli? He was the high priest in Israel at that time. Unfortunately, though, Eli and his sons weren't really getting the job done. And it wasn't long before they were pushed aside. There was sort of this spiritual leadership vacuum in Israel at this time. Samuel was God's answer to that spiritual leadership vacuum in the nation of Israel at this time. And so far, God has been doing primarily most of his revealing and working through Samuel, and now Samuel's dead. And you think, well, that's no big deal because Eli and his sons are gone. We'll just get some more priests on behalf of God. But there's one problem. Do you remember what Saul did to all the priests a few chapters ago? He killed them all, right? In a fit of rage and fury, he thought that the priests were conspiring with David, and so he just went in and wiped them all out. So we've got this big spiritual vacuum now in the nation of Israel now that Samuel's gone. And it's kind of just teasing us with, like, how's God going to bring himself back into his people's lives? We're going to find out more about that later. But nevertheless, it's important that you know Samuel is now gone. Picking up in the second half of verse 1, it says, then David rose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. And there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep, 1,000 goats, and was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife was Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite. So far, before we go any further, we get a description here of this guy named Nabal who's going to enter into conflict with David. But before we go further, I think it's important that we pay attention to what God has told us about this guy. Okay? You with me? So, what do we know about Nabal? He was rich. Okay? Very good. He was married, okay, to a discerning and beautiful woman named Abigail. He was a jerk, right? Okay? I don't care how you want to say harsh and badly behaved, but that's what I think of. And finally, he was a Calebite, okay? Now, I get rich. Well, I don't really, but I can imagine rich, okay? I get married. I'm married. And I get jerk. But what does Calebite have to do with the story? I wonder why God wanted us to know that he was a Calebite. Well, just remember that anytime God gives us a detail like that, it means something. So I was stumped with this Calebite thing this week as I was studying, and I couldn't figure out why God wanted me to know that he was a Calebite. There we go. A Calebite, okay? So here's what I found out. If you go back to 1 Samuel chapter 16, where we meet David outside of Bethlehem. David was from Bethlehem. Do you know which tribe happened to settle and found Bethlehem? The Calebites. If you look, it's in 2 Chronicles, I believe. There's a descendant, but the Calebites were believed to have been some of the founding fathers of Bethlehem. So at some level, we can assume that at some point David and Nabal were probably related. It's probably distant, it's probably far off, but nevertheless, they have this connection of Bethlehem. At least that's what my commentaries told me. I don't personally know that much about Calebites and Israelite history, but that's what I learned through this. And the reason that's significant is, in a sense, it would have been like David was about to enter into a relationship with a long-lost family member. Boy, I'm all rattled now. I got myself confused here a bit. But anyway, so that's what's going on here. Now let's find out how David and Nabal interact. So David, in verse 4, heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. And so David sent 10 young men. And David said to the young men, "Go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus you shall greet him. Peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. I hear that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm. And they missed nothing all the time that we were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have on hand to your servants and to your son, David." So what's going on here in the story for today? Essentially, David being on the run, they have no home base, per se. They don't have a hookup at McDonald's. No Dylan's gift cards. They're fresh out. Can you imagine yourself and 600 men trying to make it out in the wilderness on very little? They come across some shepherds who are out in the field. I don't know. The text doesn't tell us for sure if they recognize them as Nabal's men or what. But David refers to himself as Nabal's son, implying that there's some family connection here. It wouldn't be unreasonable to think that David knew that somehow this was a far-off, distant relative. And so they say, "Hey, you know what? Let's strike up a deal here. I've had some experience shepherding, right? I'll make a deal. we'll hang out with you guys, and we'll help take care of these sheep. We'll help protect them for you. And as the, while they're there, David and his men behave very honorably among Nabal's men and his shepherds. And so feast day comes, and David thinks, okay, here's my chance. Nabal, would you just compensate us for some of the protection and help that we have given your men? And on this feast day, would you just share some of your blessing with us? Would you share some of your food with us? And so this is David's plan. And so he says, I'm going to send a few of my guys to meet with Nabal and to make this request. What do you think Nabal's going to say? Let's look in verse 9. It says, when David's young men came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David, and then they waited. And Nabal answered David's servants, who's David? Who's this son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I've killed for my shearers and give it to men who come from I don't know where? So David's young men turned away and came back and told him all this. Now don't look. How do you think, just based on what you know of David so far, how do you think David's going to respond? So far, the David that we know has been pretty good about taking stuff in stride. He's been this sort of gentle, like, servant of the Lord, obedient, faithful, trusting in God. Even when circumstances don't seem to go his way, he's got his head on. But listen to what David says today. Verse 13, and David said to his men, oh, come on! Learn how to drive! He loses it in this moment. He doesn't say that, but listen to what he says. He says, and David said, every man, strap on your sword. We're going Nabal hunting. Strap on your sword. And every man of them strapped on his sword, and David also strapped on his sword. And about 400 men went up after David, while 200 remained with the baggage. David loses his ever-loving mind for some reason here. I don't know if it was the stress of hunger or being on the run or if Nabal's words were just too offensive to him after all that he had done for Nabal. Does not matter. At this moment, David's heart is filled with evil. He said, guys, get your swords on. And I just imagine Nabal at this point with this like Scottish kilt, like some wavy Mel Gibson hair and some blue face paint. Freedom! He's going to go get him some Nabal, okay? And he loses it, and he calls his men together and say, we're going. And in this moment of anger and rage and just losing it, David is about to make a huge mistake. This is not the David we've seen so far. And in this moment, don't you just scratch your head sometimes and wonder and wish God would just send someone to you to just put your head back on straight, to calm you down, to cool you off, to remind you of who you are and where you're going? Well, watch this. So David's young men turned away and came back to him and told him all this. And David said to his men, every man, strap on your sword. And every man strapped on his sword. And David also strapped on his sword. And about 400 men went up after David, while 200 remained with the baggage. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to greet our master, and he railed at them. Verse 15, yet the men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm. And we didn't miss anything when we were in the fields, as long as we went with them. They were a wall to us, both in the fields, and as long as we went with, they were a wall to us, both by night and by day. All the while, we were there with them, keeping the sheep. Now, therefore, know this, and consider what you should do, for harm is determined against our master and against all his house, and he is such a worthless man that no one can even speak to him. So one of Nabal's guys observed David's men coming and making a plea to Nabal to give them some food as compensation for the services that they provided. And they watched Nabal's response, which also was completely out of line. And this servant begins to grow worried. He understands that David is not somebody to mess around with. And while David's character has been very pure and upright so far, they also know that he's done some scary stuff, right? Killed the bear, killed the lion, killed the giant, okay? Not the guy you want to tick off, okay? Nevertheless, at this moment, the servant's watching all this. He's like, I don't know if this is going to play out good for us. So rather than going to Nabal, because he knows he can't go there, he goes to Nabal's wife, Abigail. And he's like, Abigail, I need to bring you in on something. I don't have a good feeling about this. I've got red flags going up everywhere. Look, some of David's men came, and they wanted some help, but Nabal just lost it on them. And I'm afraid that David might just turn and retaliate. And I think we need to do something. But I can't go to Nabal. So I wanted to make you aware of this. And so what's Abigail's response? Look in verse 18. It says, then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already prepared, and 5 seahs of parched grain, and hundreds of clusters of raisins, and 200 cakes of figs, and laid them on donkeys. And she said to her young men, go on before me. Behold, I come after you. But she did not tell her husband Nabal. And as she rode on the donkey and came down under the cover of the mountain, behold, David and his men came down toward her, and she met them. Now David had said, surely in vain I have guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness. Surely that nothing was missed and all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. God, do so to the enemies of David, and more also if by morning I have so much as one male of all of you who belong to him. And in this scene, we see Abigail putting together enough food to feed a youth group. She's throwing it on the donkeys. She's getting ready to haul them out to meet David. And as she's going, she finds, as she moves around this mountain, she meets David. And David is still on his donkey, muttering and sputtering. What does he say? Surely in vain I have guarded all this fellow has in the wilderness so that nothing was missing. And I did all this and blah, 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 blah. David is still fuming mad. But nevertheless, as he's going, and as his donkey meets her donkey's eyes, they stop. And Abigail runs to David. And listen to what she does. And by the way, if you want to talk about bravery, culturally speaking, what this woman does is so incredibly out of place here. But nevertheless, she gets off her donkey. It says, and when Abigail saw David, she hurried and got down from the donkey and fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. And she fell at his feet and said, on me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Please, let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Okay, before I go any further, there's a lot of lords in this passage, and it gets really confusing if you're just listening to me. Some of the lords are capitalized, some of them are not. When it's capitalized, read along with me if you're not already. That's God. When it's not capitalized, she's talking about David, okay? If you just listen, you'll be messed up when I'm done here. Okay, so verse 24, she fell at his feet. On me alone, my little case, Lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. I figured out, Nabal is not the best name. Have you seen it on any, like, 2018 name lists so far, as far as popular names? Have you ever known a Nabal? Here's why. Nabal means intellectually or ethically foolish. So not really a trendsetter, okay? So don't name your kids Nabal if you care about the meaning of their name. And so Abigail's appealing to David, and she's like, David, just forget my husband. He's living up to his name right now. So just please have mercy on us right now. And so in verse 25, it says, let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord from whom you sent. Now then, my Lord, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving you and from saving with your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as Nabal. And now this is a present that your servant has brought to my Lord to be given to the young men who follow my Lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant. For the Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord. And evil shall not be found in you as long as you live. If men rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be found in the bundle of the living care of the Lord your God. Isn't that a cool statement? And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pains of conscience, having shed blood without cause for my Lord, working salvation for himself. And when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your servants. So Abigail, she hears about the situation. She loads up her donkeys full of food, wine, gifts for David. And I got to be honest with you, when I read that section, verses 18 through 22, I really thought that when I got to the part where Abigail was going to meet David, I really imagined her with all this food and these gifts, getting on her knees and saying, oh, please, 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 please don't kill me. Please don't kill me. Please don't kill my people. I really kind of imagined her pleading for her life and for the life of her people. But did you hear her plead that at all in this section? What is she pleading in this section? It's so wild. It's so cool. Essentially, if you go back through and read this, she's saying, David, I know who you are. This is not you. And I'm pleading, don't do this. Don't try to work salvation with your own hand. Let God do it for you. And in this moment, Abigail is not even pleading for her own life. Now, I guess you could argue in kind of an abstract, behind-the-scenes way she sort of is, because she knows that if this plea is effective, she will be spared. But nevertheless, as she approaches David in his, she doesn't plead for her life. And guess what else she also doesn't do? She doesn't say, David, I can't even believe you. Who could you become? What a worthless piece of garbage you are. She doesn't appeal to his sin. She appeals to who God's called him to be. What a powerful lesson for us. What if we got really good at that as a church? We see maybe one of our brothers and sisters in the, and instead of coming down on them, and instead of reminding them of all the things they've done wrong, what if we came to them and reminded them of who they are? This isn't you. I know you. Christ has changed you. God has plans for you, and this is going to mess up all of it. I just can't imagine getting my feathers that ruffled if somebody came to me in that spirit. But you know what we usually do? What is wrong with you? You call yourself a Christian? Come on, get it together. And then we go off and do the same thing. What is Abigail's approach here? She's appealing to who she believes David really is. The plan that God has for David. Did you catch that? Listen to this in verse 30. She said, and when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over evil or over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief pangs or conscience for having shed blood without cause for my Lord. She knows exactly who David is. She's aware of what God has promised him. And she knows that he's going to be the next prince over Israel. The way that she pulls David back isn't by bashing him over the head, but it's reminding him of what God has promised him and who he is in God's plan. Man, I want to go to Abigail's church. Like, wouldn't that be, I love this church, by the way, but wouldn't that be cool? Like, I want to be like that. I want to be that kind of brother to you. Does it work? David's pretty hot, mind you. Let's look in verse 32. It says, and David said to Abigail, blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from working salvation with my own hand. Abigail, throws a Hail Mary at this point with her donkeys and her figs. And she comes to David. She meets him where he's at, reminds him of who he is, and stops David in his tracks. And in that moment, David realizes something very important. David realized Abigail was sent ultimately by God. Did you catch that? He said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you to me this day to pull my head out, to put it back on straight, to save me from doing something foolish and from trying to work salvation with my own hands." Now, I wish I could take you through the rest of the story, but I'm running short on time. You can read the rest of the story. It gets a little weird. David gets into this kind of sister wives gig at the end. We'll talk about that more later, but it doesn't go well for David, so you know. Polygamy doesn't work. There's more about that coming. So I'm going to encourage you to read the rest of this. But when you get home, don't worry about it too much because God doesn't speak to that yet. But I believe later, as we see David's life and all the drama that comes in through taking these other wives, we soon realize this is not the best idea. But nevertheless, I want to stop right here for today. And I want to look at what God did in this chapter. And let's just be honest, this chapter is a little weird. Because as I said earlier, it doesn't seem to really fit with this story of Saul. Where's Saul in all this? I thought David was on the run from Saul. I was really looking forward to see what happened after he cut the corner off of his cloak. And yet we get this really bizarre story, almost as a parenthesis, before in chapter 26, don't worry, we're going back to Saul. But why 25? What was this about? And I'll be honest with you, this week as I was studying, I tried to figure that out. Lord, why did you put this story in here? What is the significance? Why? What does this mean? Because to me, it feels really disconnected at this point from the greater story. And so as I began to think about that and pray through that, I went back and started reading again just the story of 1 Samuel. And as I came to chapter 24, I was like, oh yeah, I get it now. Do you guys remember what happens in 24? It's so good. Okay, so here's what happens in 24. So David is hiding from Saul. He's out in the wilderness. He's near a cave. And all of a sudden, David and his men hear something coming from far away. Who do they hear? They hear King Saul and his men. They're coming to kill him. He says, uh-oh. So he gets in the cave. And remember, he hides with his men in this cave. And as the men approach, they get closer and closer and closer. And David's like, please, 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 please keep going. Please keep going. But they don't keep going. In fact, they hear all the commotion stop just outside of the cave. And lo and behold, what happens? As chance or whatever you want to call it, divine providence would have it, Saul himself has to go to the bathroom. And he steps inside of the cave. And in that moment of intense vulnerability right in front of David, David has Saul right where he wants him. And what does he do? He passes it up. The very man that has been trying to kill him is in a spot where David could end it all right now. He could quit this whole mess, go back to Michal, his first wife, go back to his friend Jonathan, go home to receive the crown and be the next king. The only thing was that God didn't tell David to do that. And David knew that. And he says, who am I to lift my hand against the king's against God's anointed? And in chapter 24, we see a David show tremendous restraint towards Saul. And we see David show tremendous faith in God in chapter 24. So much so that when you get done reading chapter 4, you can't help but imagine David running around with his underpants on the outside of his pajamas and a cape flowing freely and the whole little the hair thing. He is basically Superman at this point. The David that we have seen this far doesn't seem like he can lose or fail. The picture that we've been given of David is just like, oh, this guy is incredible. And then lo and behold, you turn the next page. And what do you see? You see David losing his mind because some rich guy won't share his food with him. so much so that he's going to kill him and his whole family. And as I begin to see now, those two chapters come together now, a passage from the New Testament pops into my head. And I want to close with that passage. In this passage, I think we get just a great picture, a summary almost, of what we've seen in these two chapters here. So turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and we're going to look at verses 12 and 13. It's funny, I was telling my wife this week, I thought of 13 first, but then later, as I was going over and over again, verse 12 hit me as well, but I didn't know they were side by side. They were both verses I had memorized as a kid, but I never put them together as two verses that were back to back with each other. So as I was looking these verses up and say, like, God, is there something here? Is there something you want me to learn from 1 Corinthians chapter 10? And once I realized those verses were back to back to each other, it was like he just whacked me over the head with a 2x4. Listen to what he says. I think there's a warning here and an encouragement here for us. In verse 12, it says, therefore, let anyone thinks that he stands, take heed lest he fall. I think there's a warning in 1 Samuel chapter 25 as we see David, the giant slayer, the bear killer, the lion clobberer, the Philistine puncher. There's a temptation as we read through this story to almost elevate David so high that he can't fail. I wonder if David wasn't perhaps wrestling with a similar thing in his own mind. And in this moment, we see that there is none of us that are ever so strong that we're never weak. There's none of us that ever graduate from needing grace. There's none of us that ever do it so right that we sort of slip into this place. We can just coast. Let him who stands take heed lest he fall. But then listen to what he says next. He says, no temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. I love this part. Hang your hat on this part right here. But God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. Now think about our story for today as I read this next part. But with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. Can I tell you one of the coolest things about being a Christian is not that you're somehow now perfect. Don't get me wrong. In God's eyes, as he looks down at his children, we are perfect because he sees Jesus. If he sees anything less or anything else, you're in trouble, okay? So in that sense, you're perfect. And you need to be because that's how it's got to be, okay? You know that I'm not perfect yet, right? And I'm silly and foolish and I do damage when I pretend that I am or that I think that I've arrived. One of the coolest things about being a Christian is not that how sometimes now I have my life all together, everything goes perfectly, and I never mess up anymore. One of the coolest things about being a Christian is that when I mess up, or when I am tempted to mess up, God is faithful to provide a way out every single time. He doesn't leave us hanging. He doesn't leave us to figure it out on our own. Now, that being said, so many times in my own life, I have been insistent upon figuring out on my own. And in those cases, he says, okay, Jason, when you're done, I'm here for you. But isn't it cool that we serve a God that no matter what temptation comes our way, he is right there making an alternative route, dropping detour after detour after detour for us. Want to know why? Because he knows who we are. He knows who we really are. He, more than anyone, knows our identity in Christ, and he knows the plans that he has for our life. And that temptation, that thing that you're looking at that day, is not for you. And it is his heart and his desire to lead his children away and out. I think sometimes we just need to open our eyes and look at the Abigail that's staring us in the face. God provides for his children. And maybe today we need to start praying. God, would you just litter my path with Abigails, with people who will speak into my life, who will call me by your name, who will remind me who I am, and remind me of your plan. And in that moment, would you provide for me a way of escape? Good news, guys. We're not perfect yet. But as we walk through this life, God is providing ways out. He's providing paths of victory over paths of failure. Would you be willing to look for that as you go into this next week? Would you begin to just ask, God, would you open my eyes as I trust that you will provide? And see if he doesn't begin to turn your little shepherd heart into a king. See if he doesn't interrupt evil in your life. Let's pray. God, we are thankful to you that you are so faithful to us, that you are patient with us, but also that you provide for us in every way. Lord, even when we are facing temptation, even when we are at 30th and Lorraine, Lord, at 30th and Lorraine, you are there. And whatever the temptation may be this week, whether we are just tempted to be weak or tempted to dive headfirst into sin, God, would you open our eyes to the Abigails that you have set before us? Would you call us by our name, remind us of who we are and the life that you're leading us towards? And in that moment, would we reach out and take your hand and trust you as we seek to follow Jesus? In your name, amen.